Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:56 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 9th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off this week with the dollar, because this long-term chart is not a particularly easy one to analyze, because we can see, for example, that between about 1977 and until quite recently, there have been a number of occasions when the index bounced from around the 80 level. So it's been a meaningful area of potential support over a very long period of time. But beyond a more casual examination of the chart, well, what we can see is, in fact, that yes, 80 has been the average level at which support has been found, but we do have lower lows. So on each occasion that the dollar pulls back in a very meaningful fashion, and there have been a number of those occasions over the course of the last 40 years, that it in fact moves to new lows before rebounding. Then when it rebounds, each of the successive rebounds has been lower than the last. So when we then think about what can we anticipate next, if this pattern were to be broken, then the index would need to at least rally through the 100 level and then sustain it. That would clearly demonstrate that we're back in a dollar demand driven environment, that there is an acute shortage of the currency, that there were competitive interest rates to encourage people into it, or that there were sufficiently challenging global environments that were creating an attractive safe haven aspect to the US dollar. Those are the potential outcomes. Unfortunately, the interest rate argument is unlikely in the near term, or indeed in the medium term. Then when we think about the trajectory of governance, well, I think when we think about everything that's going on in terms of the US election, then obviously it's, I think, reasonable to conclude that the standards of governance have deteriorated over the course of the last 5 or 6 years. And that represents a risk factor for an international investor in the currency. Then when we just simply look at the response of the dollar index to news, then it does tend to decline every time the potential for additional stimulus is more likely. And that was certainly the case in here today. The Trump administration, having walked away from negotiations earlier in the week, walked back in here today. President Trump is talking about looking for an additional spending program even greater than what the Democrats had been proposing. So there is the potential that there will be a deal, and it will represent at least $1 trillion, or potentially even $2 trillion, of additional spending. And obviously that is a significant slug of additional supply. So then the question of whether there's going to be a limited supply argument to support the value of the dollar over the course of the next few years is, I think, right out there in the most unlikely of scenarios. So there's the potential here that we're going to see the dollar take another leg lower, because the USA is now by far the most activist in terms of attempting to devalue its currency. There's, and one of David's adages over a lengthy period of time was that no country wants to have a strong currency, but some countries need a weaker currency more than others, and right now the USA needs a weaker currency. So there is the clear scope that we're going to see additional downside. Now that's going to have significant knock-on effects for a whole slew of assets. And it reprises the kind of market environment that we had during the early 2000s. That was when we had a meaningful deterioration in the US dollar. And if we just simply go back and just look at just that portion, the dollar peaked right after the technology market popped, the bull market popped in 2000. By the time we got around to the end of the bear market in 2002, the solution to the bear market was devalue the currency. And that was also a time when people were talking seriously about financial repression. So that's, I think, a rather significant factor as well, because it's a very relevant topic of conversation in here today. Now, when we then think about, well, what could we anticipate today? Because the dollar is nowhere near 120. It's pulling back from 100. So we've had a meaningful move on the upside over the course of the last decade. There's the clear potential now that it is going to fail here and that we're going to see it pull back. If this is the same kind of trend change that we saw in the early 2000s, then the logical conclusion from that very long-term chart would be that the dollar is going to fall to new lows and that it will take out the low put in all the way back in 2008, that we're going to see the dollar fall through the 70 level. Now, if that's the case, then it would be, the clear conclusion would be that since the dollar index is heavily weighted by the euro, that the euro would have to strengthen. Well, there is very little tolerance for that kind of strength in the euro within the eurozone. So if we are simply drawing conclusions based upon the price action, it would suggest that the euro is going to get significantly stronger from here. And it's hard to imagine how that's likely, considering that the Europeans are already starting to talk about the strength of the euro and what they can do to try and arrest its advance. Nonetheless, the price action is positive. It does look increasingly likely that the euro will strengthen from here, because the Europeans are not doing as much as the USA is in order to devalue their currency. In fact, they are prohibited from issuing quite as much as the USA is doing by the whole raft of regulations that have been imposed upon the ECB and governments in order to try and balance budgets, to constrain debt-to-GDP ratio expansion, and to ensure that the monetary system functions correctly. What has happened, however, in Europe is that they have now created federal bonds, or at least the equivalent of federal bonds, and there's no contractual or treaty negotiation around the creation of these federal bonds, and therefore there is no limit on how large they can be. There is the potential over the long term that Europe will have the same kind of federalization of debt that the USA had. And then that obviously would help to perhaps make a better case for why the euro should be strong. One, I think, important point is that if we were to look at the euro on a the eurozone as one country, then the debt to GDP ratio is manageable. In fact, it's better than Japan, probably better than China's, and better than the USA's. Obviously, there are patches where Italian and Spanish debt ratios are both high and the absolute level of debt is large, but then the size of the creditor nations' economies relative to their debt is comparatively low by comparison, and then if you were to take the total, then Europe's debt to GDP ratios are in fact lower than anywhere else's. So that at least should be an area where we could have some source of demand for the currency. At least that's a rationalization of what we see in the chart action, because so far the ECB has talked about trying to suppress the value of the euro, but they haven't really done anything yet. Then when we think about the yen, well, It's another major component of the dollar index. And the dollar has had a sequence of lower rally highs against the yen since 2015. Now, it is currently rebounding, but every time it comes up to, regardless of the long, that five-year sequence of lower rally highs, and just think about the short-term five-month sequence of lower rally highs, every time it gets up here, it fails. So there is the potential here that the yen is also going to appreciate from these levels. Well, at least that is what the chart action tells us, that if we simply look at this the other way around and look at it on a longer term basis, we had a significant downtrend between 2011 and 2015. We had a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend. Now we are in this very lengthy period of right-hand extension. There's a sequence of higher reaction lows within the range. If we were to take the labels off the charts, this looks like a chart that is more than likely to break on the upside eventually. And when that happens, well, then we're seriously talking about significant yen strength, but then also dollar weakness. So there are bullish patterns for major currencies against the US dollar. But these major currencies are also countries that are not at all enamored with the idea of allowing their currencies to appreciate against the dollar. Meanwhile, China has rebounded, the renminbi rebounded immediately after the market opened from the Golden Week holiday, and it's at a new high. It's very clearly broken its downtrend, and there is the clear potential here that we're going to see additional upside. And it's probably also better to just simply flip it around and look at it the other way. So there is a very clear bullish chart here for the renminbi. It has emphatically broken the downtrend. That's important, because what we can then look at is the wider emerging markets sector. And the Asia dollar index has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs. And I do think this is one of the more important characteristics we've seen, because it's been a long time since there was real bullish interest in the emerging markets. We had a really very impressive rebound in emerging markets after the financial crisis, and that persisted for just about 2.5 years. Then their currencies started to be devalued, and the stock markets went with the currencies. International investors like to have the interest rate and the central bank on their side, but when they've got the currency on their side as well, then you get capital market, currency market, and debt market appreciation, and that's when money floods into the emerging markets. China is the linchpin for the emerging markets, because it represents a massive slug of market cap of the emerging market index. It's approximately 45% of all of the emerging markets. So really, it is what we've often talked about the Wall Street leash effect, but the reality is that from an emerging market investor's perspective, you have the China leash effect, because so many emerging market indices focus on China. So that's, I think, a significant factor. Whatever happens in terms of the renminbi is going to have a much wider effect on the entire emerging markets sector. And there is clear evidence now that we're starting to see the dollar breaking down against emerging market currencies, Asian currencies, but especially the renminbi. And that's a clear break of trend. Until a year ago, China had absolutely no interest in allowing its currency to appreciate. But it does now appear to be willing to allow the currency to appreciate. And there is the argument that China is running what is the equivalent of traditional traditional monetary policy. They were tightening their policy heading into this crisis. Now they are being somewhat more accommodative, but the reality is that yields have risen, and usually in a recession, yields do rise. They are at least coming out of a recession, yields rise. So, and China is coming out of a recession. Hotel occupancy has perked right back up. In fact, it has completely regained the entire decline. So I think that is an additional important characteristic, that we've seen that China has been able to come through this incredibly difficult and traumatic year in much better condition than a large number of other countries. So I think that's certainly true, that China has been able to get back to going to cinemas, restaurants, and also people visiting tourist sites, hotel occupancy, and airlines. They're all back, or at least close to back to normality. And then, of course, there have been significant exports of protective equipment, furniture in particular, because of the migration of people from apartments into suburbia. And then, of course, bigger houses require more furniture. That's also been a major export for China. So they're coming out of this this recession in pretty robust form. The government bond yield is potentially attractive from an international investor's perspective at about 3%, substantially higher than what one can get on US treasuries. So obviously that's something that people will be considering. But then when you have the currency on your side as well, then you're not just getting 3%, but you're potentially getting more than that. And this is the argument that applies to emerging markets just about everywhere, that when we get significant deterioration in the dollar, then it bids up at the value of just about every other market. So Indian government bonds are back below the 6% level, and they didn't rally particularly much in the panicky period. India is in recession. They haven't come through the COVID pandemic quite as strongly as China has, and the RBI is talking trying to talk interest rates down. The Indian stock market continues to benefit from what are effectively negative real interest rates, and the Nifty was up again in positive territory in here today, and it is really on the cusp now of breaking on the upside. When we look at the best performers of the Nifty this year, then it's the lab companies and the outsourcing companies. Then you've got Reliance Industries being the largest company out there. But this ability of some of, well, I guess these are the companies that represent India's window on the world, that it's a massive center for outsourcing. And then it's also, and that applies from everywhere to IT, to the provision of basic pharmaceutical ingredients and generic drugs. And there's been an acute demand for all of those types of services over the course of this year. But then when we think about the wider emerging markets region, then we can see, for example, that the Aberdeen New Dawn Investment Trust broke out to new highs in here today. It has been doing better than the wider emerging markets index over the course of this last decade. Part of the reason for that has been the weakness of the pound. But even When we redenominate it into dollars, it is breaking on the upside to new highs in here today. When we then think about the emerging markets ETF, which is admittedly very heavily weighted by China, then it is pushing up to new, almost two-year highs. But the bigger picture here is that emerging markets generally have been going sideways for a decade. And they've been ranging below the $50 area now for approximately 13 years. So this is potentially the catalyst it's been waiting for, that emerging markets don't generally tend to start to attract interest until the currency is very clearly in favor. And that's equally true of ADRs that are, and I thought the ADRE fund was a good example of that. This is an index of all of 50 of the largest ADRs from emerging markets listed in the USA. So it's got Taiwan Semiconductor and Alibaba. Well, these are world-class companies. They just happen to be in the emerging markets. Taiwan Semiconductor continues to accelerate higher. Its dominance of 7 nanometer chips is just unassailable at this stage. Then we have Alibaba, and that also pushed on to new highs in here today and is pulling away from what was effectively a three-year range. So there is clear demand coming through for the big cap companies, certainly those that are levered to either the technology sector or the consumer sector in Asia, because those represent growth opportunities. Then we have the argument about the currency that is helping to support interest in the emerging markets. Well, then there's also the potential that we're going to have significant infrastructure development. And the continuous commodity index was in additional positive territory today, but it has rebounded really rather impressively over the last 2 weeks from the 400-point level. So it hasn't quite broken through to new highs for the year, but it's probably only a few days away from completing that move. And this does look like an index that can push on to additional new highs. When we look at the LME Metals Index, which is just the industrial resources, then it has clearly broken its sequence of lower rally highs. So when we then think and go back and think about the continuous commodity index, it's not the industrial resources that are holding it back. It's certainly not gold, but the agricultural commodities had been rather quiet, but they sprung to life over the last few weeks. And corn is now coming up to test the $4 area. It has failed at this level on multiple occasions over the last 6 years, but this may be the occasion on which it can push higher. Soybeans are rallying as well and have broken through the 1,000 cent level. So that's also looking encouraging, that soybeans do look like they're moving higher. Then we have wheat. It hasn't quite broken out yet, but it certainly is starting to steady and pulled back from the 600 cent level in here today. I do think, though, that these are all base formations. And one thing that is disencouraging about base formations is you do tend to get failed upside breaks until they do eventually complete the bases. So we can't really have faith that this is a completed base until we've seen the breakout sustained for a couple of weeks, and we're not quite there yet. But it is looking increasingly encouraging that the industrials have led on the upside and that the agriculturals are going to play catch-up. So sugar prices have also rebounded from the lows earlier this year. The 10-cent level has been an area of support on multiple occasions since 2015 and then going all the way back to 2006 through 2009. And again, this looks like a base formation. So there's the potential here that we're going to see commodity prices do substantially better. And then, of course, the rationale behind that would be that it's because of a weakening dollar and also because of renewed demand from the emerging markets. The spot industrial resources index, or the raw industrials, it's not all industrial metals, but industrial resources. Then that's hasn't quite broken the downtrend, but the 200-day moving average has certainly turned upwards. And I think the other point is that gold has been leading on the upside for a while now. And it was in positive territory again in here today. It has been in a process of consolidation now for the last 3 months. The most important thing that it's done in that 3 months was to rally today to break the sequence of lower rally highs. We had a very small downside key reversal on Tuesday, and then no follow-through, and then it was superseded in here today. So we have now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It's confirming support around the $1,850 area, and it's increasing the potential that we may not, in fact, see a full reversion back down towards the mean. And that is really very bullish action. It was pretty much mirrored on the gold ETFs. So the gold miners ETF has firmed, and it's still a sequence of ranges, one above another. This is the hallmark of a consistent trend. It has also just about unwound all of its overextension relative to the trend mean. So this is, I think, a rather encouraging action. One thing that I think is particularly relevant to highlight is that gold tends to move in lockstep with emerging markets. And part of the reason for that is because of the currency. Well, the dollar has been rather steady against the main currencies. It's the ability of the dollar to, or of emerging markets to outperform against the dollar is the clear catalyst to reignite interest in emerging markets from a medium-term perspective. It's pretty similar to what we had at the end of the tech bubble. There was a clear determination to keep interest rates low for a prolonged period of time to try and reignite growth. That's exactly what we're seeing right now. The Federal Reserve has told us they're not going to raise interest rates, potentially for years. There's the significant question about exactly what's going to happen when the really big moves that we've seen in terms of forgiving debt, of the kinds of hiatus that we've had, or the moratoriums that have on debt collection that have been introduced. Obviously, these are significant unknowns, and what that's going to entail in terms of economic growth into 2021 when the moratoriums run off. So obviously, those are going to be factors that are going to certainly be discussed by politicians in their determination about exactly how much additional stimulus they're going to make available. But it virtually ensures there will be additional stimulus. There are millions of people that are unemployed. The this entire adage, or this catchphrase from the lockdowns that we're all in this together, is simply not true. There has been a very clear delineation between those which have come through the lockdowns comparatively unaffected, or in fact coming out ahead because their costs have contracted without their wages contracting. Then there are people who have been extremely affected because, particularly those that live in multi-generational households, so that some people will have lost their income. then they are much more likely to have passed on the virus to members of their family. So they may have lost people from their family units. They've been wholly dependent on government largesse, and then their neighborhoods have been ravaged by significant social unrest as well. So that incredible delineation pretty much ensures that we are not all in this together. There is an acute need for additional stimulus to support the less well-advantaged people in society, and that number of less well-advantaged people is really very significant as a proportion of the entire economy, and therefore we're likely to see significant additional stimulative measures. This is likely to include direct payments. Now, these direct payments are happening on an ad hoc basis at present, and I think Jeff Gundlach makes the very reasonable point that Social Security in itself is some form of universal basic income, and it's likely to be expanded as a result of the coronavirus. That's what all of these stimulative packages represent. And that's likely to be a phenomenon that we see not only in the USA, but also in other countries. In the UK, for example, they're talking about providing additional stimulative measures to hotbeds or to of virus outbreaks. And these types of supportive measures are difficult to withdraw once introduced. So there's the clear scope that what we're going to see is the outperformance of emerging market currencies relative to developed market currencies. And I think that's, I think, the big takeaway. When we think about the lead that gold has offered, gold has been rallying now for more than a year. And when we think about gold on a purchasing power parity basis, then it's really only been consolidating in the region of the previous peak. It's been ranging for a prolonged period below the 250 level, and this doesn't look like anything other than a simple consolidation. There's a clear determination in government circles to devalue the purchasing power of fiat currencies. That's part of the reason why housing prices continue to rise, because interest rates are very low, the supply element is constrained, and demand has increased. So we've seen property prices jumping higher in places like Australia, the UK, and the USA for exactly those reasons. And the decline of the purchasing power of the dollar is likely to continue to benefit asset prices for as long as it takes inflation to make a comeback. Now, the big question is, when will the velocity of money start to turn around again? And will that, in fact, prompt central banks to start to withdraw the stimulus? And I'm rather on of two minds as to whether that will indeed be the case. I thought this was a rather interesting chart that I saw this week. So we can see, for example, that in the early 1970s, we had a period where inflation actually came down. But then it ramped higher for a very short period of time between about 1973 and 1975, so that was the oil shock. Then it came back down a bit, but then it ramped back up again, and it stayed high for and stayed well above the 6% level for approximately 5 years. And after that, then with interest rates at extraordinary levels, then the interest rate and the inflation rate started to come back down. So the question now is, are we in a similar situation to what happened in the 1970s. Well, we certainly had a period of social unrest in the late 1960s. So that was certainly a factor. With the student protests in Paris, the French government were fearful of a revolution. Then you had assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy within 3 months of one another. So those were incredible situations. And then what do governments do? They print money. That's exactly what we're seeing today. They make additional funds available. And I'll never forget my mother telling me about the kinds of building projects that went on in Ireland during the early 1970s, and it almost bankrupted the country, and that turned off a generation of people from voting for the party that had introduced that massive spending. But the reality is that it helped to contain housing prices for a prolonged period, and it allowed the rest of young population to get onto the housing ladder. Obviously, there were significant penalties in the form of inflation and higher taxes as a result of that massive building boom. But the debt monetization, which was a factor that came through in large numbers of countries at the time, was a causal factor in the demand of the Arab nations for additional increases in the oil price. That was what happened ahead of the oil shocks. So now we're at a point where we're seeing debt ramping up, we're seeing governments increasingly willing to monetize the debt, and that's clearly what the central banks are telling governments to do. This isn't just happening in one country, it's happening in many countries. That's exactly what we saw with debt monetization back in the early 1970s. It was as popular in European countries as it was in the USA, and it's likely to be a global phenomenon right now. The number of emerging markets that are engaged in quantitative easing has risen substantially. So you certainly have countries like India and Indonesia and Poland buying their own debt. So that's certainly something that is quite clear. One thing that we can also think about is that the 1970s were a period where liberalism really took over in terms of the political establishment. And there was also a very similar and clear response to high oil prices, which was to pioneer solar cells, which was to champion alternative fuels. Of course, they didn't work back then. That was 50 years ago. And now, arguably, people are going to say they don't work today either. But the reality is that the cost of producing solar cells has contracted really very significantly over the last decade. And that is very much a function of scale of manufacturing. It was in back in the 1970s, it was $100 for a module. Today, because of the scale and the size of the market, going from 1 megawatt in 1977 to 100,000 megawatts in 2012, and more than that in here today, significantly more than that, because this is a log scale chart, then it's only costing 50 cents. It's at a point now where solar is competitive with fossil fuels in certain parts of the world on an unsubsidized basis. That's also true of wind. So then we've got the additional point that China says they're going to be carbon neutral by 2060, I think. Then the Europeans have said they're going to spend 2 trillion on a Green New Deal, and the solar sector has taken off like a rocket. So there are a number of different factors that are helping to prepare to propel this move. There is also the clear potential for wind turbines to continue to increase in size and generating capacity. The intermittency, though, of renewables, it has been something that has been the thorn in their side now for as long as they've been around. But battery technology continues to improve. Tesla's announcements at its Battery Day about 2 weeks ago, they disappointed the market somewhat because of the time frame that they're going to be delivered in. But the share has been steadier. The reality is that we're in an extraordinarily low interest rate environment, and that is propelling interest in speculative ventures. So there is a wall of cash that is being invested in battery research and development. The difficulty in the chemistry of battery technology means that they don't double in terms of density or charging capacity, and in the same way that the efficiency or the size of semiconductors improved. That was characterized by Moore's law. It's rather about a cycle of 4.5 years between when batteries can double in terms of their energy density. There are a number of promising developments that have been made over the course of the last 6 months that are now entering the commercial phase of development and are estimated to be delivered to the market within about 2 years. That's also exactly the same time frame that we're seeing from Tesla. So it does look likely that we're going to see the cost of batteries halve within the next 2 years, or at least by the end of the next 2 years. And that is something that will further enhance the argument for why somebody should be interested in renewables. Because what is it's effectively doing is it's a bonus for oil-consuming countries, and a large number of emerging markets are oil-consuming countries, but most particularly India and China. If solar technology continues to improve and wind continues to improve, and that is coupled with not only better batteries but cheaper batteries, then the need to continue to invest in growing supply of oil becomes less compelling. It's part of the reason why we've had companies, for example, like Royal Dutch Shell transition to natural gas, and then they've also talked about becoming one of the biggest utilities because they want to capture that cash flow. The prime attraction of electricity from an investor's perspective is that generating capacity generates utility-like cash flows. So instead of the utility-like cash flow from selling people gasoline on a weekly basis, then you get to sell them electricity on a weekly basis. The additional reason, for example, TotalFina, or just Total, has also been investing in battery technology, so they do want to have a foothold in this sector. Then we have the additional point that companies are investing in hydrogen technology. Now, the reality is that the energy sector generally has been under an incredible amount of strain, and not every energy company is going to survive. Oil prices were negative in here today, and that's because of supply questions about whether there is real justification for thinking that prices should be able to trade significantly above $40. I don't think that there's much rationale for why they should trade significantly below $40, but in order to push them above that level, we're going to have to see a supply shock, and we haven't had that yet. The bigger oil companies have got the financial heft to be able to transition. The biggest challenge is going to be for the offshore drillers, the explorers that are heavily focused in higher cost offshore jurisdictions. That's just not going to be competitive against the almost surety of finding oil in the shale regions. So there is likely to be a very significant reordering of the energy sector as a result of the evolution of renewable energy. But the bigger point is that if oil prices are going to remain reasonable, then that removes a source of headwind to growth from emerging markets. So we are potentially now at the turning point in terms of the interest in the emerging market sector. The missing ingredient was the weakness of the dollar and the willingness of emerging markets to allow their currencies to appreciate. And the most important point is that it's not just the renminbi. The Korean won, for example, has been strengthening all year. The Taiwan dollar was testing its highs earlier this week, and it broke out in here today. So it's at a new almost 10-year high. And while overbought in the short term, there is still potential for additional upside over the medium term. The Indian rupee has been trending lower for decades, but in that very lengthy period of underperformance, there have been, I think, significant periods where the currency simply went sideways and even appreciated. And I think we're probably in one of those again. The potentially very significant period for the outperformance of India was in that period from 2001 to 2007, when the rupee appreciated pretty significantly. Well, since then, it's almost halved in value. So now the question is whether it's going to be able to sustain this move above the trend mean. If we think about how is the world going to come out of the pandemic and the lockdowns and the coronavirus scare, well, the younger countries are likely to be less affected. So that certainly is in favor of the emerging markets. The most badly affected countries are those that had the most to lose, which are the developed markets. It has exposed a dearth of governance or a hole in the ability of governments to deal with new problems that are unfamiliar. And that is something that is going to require remedial action. So governance will have to improve, but it's going to, unfortunately, the response of politicians in the current system is to simply print their way out of trouble. And that is what they're doing. We have not seen a significant move in the government bond levels just yet, but it does look like a base formation. And I think the wrong conclusion is that we might have inflation. Inflationary pressures rising at a time when there are millions of people that are out of work and where there's still a lot of uncertainty, it's a crapshoot. I think it's a much more likely rationale that what we have is a solvency or a liquidity scare. Well, the liquidity scare will probably be headed off by printing money from the Federal Reserve. But if investors start to worry about the solvency of highly indebted countries, then that would necessitate higher yields. There is obviously the potential that we could get stagflation, where growth does not do particularly well and inflationary pressures start to rise. But there is the alternative potential, and it is that the economy does come back, that the quantity of money that's going to be printed is going to create an economic boom. And the boom itself will create the inflationary pressures. I think if we're going to think about what are the most likely of the scenarios, then the stimulus fueled boom scenario is probably the most likely. That if governments are willing to print trillions, and even in today's world, $1 trillion or €1 trillion or pounds is still a lot of money, then that is going to create an economic boom. We can already see what's happened in China when they were able to clamp down on the virus and stamp it out, and through the imposition of incredibly draconian measures, well, they were able to get past it. Now we're at a point in, I think, of maximum hysteria in the Western world. We know a lot more about the virus. We know who it affects. We have got effective treatment measures that can be deployed, whether that is old steroids, putting people in a prone position so that they're lying on their stomach. Even if there were a massive public information campaign about how to lead a healthier lifestyle and to get more exercise and time outdoors, that would probably do more good than anything else. I was chatting with my father yesterday. He was saying that there was a figure in the paper that there are 850,000 people waiting on hospital procedures in Ireland. The population is only 4 million. So we're talking about 20% of people that have had their hospital stays or their treatments delayed as a result of the lockdowns. Now, that is an incredibly profound number for a country that was comparatively unaffected by the coronavirus. So we have to think that the lockdowns have probably resulted in a much worse environment than might otherwise have been the case. Eventually, we're going to come out of this virus, whether it is as a result of people pulling back from this hysterical environment, or whether it's because antibody treatments are brought forward, or it's because we get vaccines. What the need is for these solutions will be open to debate, but the reality is that they're confidence-building measures, and when that confidence starts to return, then it's quite likely we are going to have the same kind of economic recoveries that are now present in China. But it's probably also going to come at the expense of the value of fiat currencies. So there is the clear potential that gold in particular is going to continue to do well, that we are still in a medium-term bull market environment, and that gold shares have got some of the most attractive margins of anywhere. But it's also likely to create a bifurcation in terms of attitudes towards stock markets because there are clear winners and losers. The technology sector continues to do well, and I don't think that that is going to change anytime soon. I did see this graphic yesterday, and it was that the e-commerce penetration figures took approximately 10 years to go from 5.5 to 16%, and then they did the same 10 years of growth in 8 weeks from during the initial portion of the lockdowns. So that's a massive transition. It's going to represent a very significant change in how businesses look at where potential resides. But the much bigger, I think, question here is that It's the quantity of money that's going to have to be printed in order to smooth out that transition. What that's going to mean in terms of the purchasing power of those currencies, and what is it investors are going to do to protect themselves. And it's looking increasingly likely that at least some money is going to come out of the developed markets, that emerging markets are going to do better, that China is going to become a more credible competitor in terms of geopolitics. What that in fact means in terms of long-term global stability is, I think, a very relevant question for later in the decade. But the reality today is that the markets are outperforming, that emerging markets are turning to outperformance, and that commodities are just starting to get off their knees. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.